Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 38. This is another impromptu episode, and this is with Rocking Mr. E, so welcome to the channel.
Thank you for inviting me to your festive extravaganza marathon, Millennial Woes. It's an honour and a privilege.
Well, you know, you interviewed me back in February, and but I've never had you on this channel, so But it's ironic because, as I said to you in that interview in February, I've been aware of you for forever. You started before I did, and I remember watching your videos back then.
Yeah, I mean, I've been going for a while, and a lot of things have changed in, you know, the approximately 6 years that I've been making videos. And, you know, my channel isn't like a huge one by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, there are various reasons for that. I just tend to talk about what I think is true and right. It doesn't put me in any particular camp per se, but on that basis, I tend to get along with people from various communities online, but I don't fit into any of them. I'm not sure if that might have something to do with it. But as well as that, you know, the quality of content online in the last, you know, over the years has increased significantly with people like Black Pigeon Speaks, for example, with his high quality of video. When I started doing videos, it was just good enough to put a webcam on and kind of just talk. Or
Interesting point. You know, I think you're right that in general, the quality level has risen because, I mean, you know, 5 years ago, if you thought of a YouTube video that somebody had made on their own, it was probably someone with a webcam. And now it's probably somebody with pretty fancy editing, a good DSLR camera, and a damn good microphone.
Yeah, and I think in the older days, say back in when at the pinnacle of men's rights, if you think of somebody like Girl Writes What and others, they would just write a quite intellectual, highbrow script or video or whatever, or create a video to that caliber. But now you've almost got to be more entertaining as well, more humorous. And that is changing the goalposts as well. And I'm kind of conscious of that as well, trying to make my videos a bit more entertaining and humorous as well, because of the attention.
I think the word would be accessible. I mean, I think we're all aware of this. And I'm actually thinking of going more lo-fi again next year, going back, and I'm wondering how far I'll be able to take it and get away with it, you know, I start losing subscribers.
it's difficult, you know. You've got to adapt and you've got to change, haven't you? Otherwise, basically, yeah, that's the nature of the beast. Unfortunately, there's no point crying about it. In an ideal world, I would really like to just kind of keep my videos simple and fine. I've often done scripts for my videos, just put the script out there. I mean. And just present that, but you've got to add more to your videos these days. I mean, certainly earlier on, it would just be like one slide and just somebody talking. That's all it was, or just somebody on a camera. And you've got to get better at editing, animation, and all these other skills that make your videos much more professional.
I have to say that's something that I'm very skeptical of that because I like simplicity. Actually, a funny thing, I've started... It's the 30-minute recording limit on my camera really annoyed me, and because I'm always having to be conscious of has it reached 30 minutes yet, and it's just a really annoying thing. It sounds nothing, but it actually is very annoying. And so I started using my camcorder recently,
right?
And the picture quality isn't as good, but there's no limit, so I can just completely forget about the time and just dive straight into the topic, and you know, and it's so much better. But the thing is, the picture quality is noticeably lower, and yet here's the thing, I don't think a single person has commented on it, the fact that the picture quality is reduced.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with video quality, it's strange, isn't it, really?
Because I was paranoid about it, and no one cares.
Yeah, and at the same time, you do have people like Stefan Molyneux that have been around for a long time, and they're just able to put on a camera and talk for 50 minutes. I know that I was always quite nervous about just talking freely on camera for a long time, because I thought, who would want to listen to me just talking at a camera? But surprisingly, people do, although still my scripted, more edited videos are the most popular. But, you know, it's finding your niche and what you're comfortable with. And I know you've got your style that kind of talking at the camera in that kind of conversational fashion. And it works really well for you, you know?
Mm. I have to say, I think it works very well for you as well, because I'd sent you a message a week or two ago saying that was the second one of your more live videos that I'd watched, more conversational. And I think it works. I think, you know, after a while you can pull it off. It takes practice.
It does. You know, because as you well know, you know, talking at a camera with nobody there is the weirdest thing. But I guess when it's live, for some reason, you're conscious that people are watching you, I guess.
Yeah.
People are talking in the comment section as we speak now, and it's a bit more real. But when you're just in a room and you're talking at a camera, there's nobody there. People should try it if they haven't before. Believe me, it takes a while to get used to.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just looking at the comments. I was wondering if anyone would comment on the picture quality, and someone's saying that I should go 8-bit.
Yeah, I've got the live chat here as well. I'll have a browse of that as the conversation progresses as well.
Commodore 64 webcam.
No, that's going back a bit. I had a Spectrum myself.
I could talk about that because I am familiar with it all, but it's probably not of interest to most of my viewers. I mean, I think a lot of them won't even have heard of these computers, which probably obviously makes me feel old.
Yeah, me too.
But anyway, we wanted to talk about the development of it's sort of going off what has happened recently with the skeptic community, but I did a long, in-depth video with JF Garipi last night, in which we went through the story, the sort of chronology of what happened. So I wouldn't want to repeat that. But I think what would be interesting with you is to talk about, the idea spaces that these things occur in. Because it seems to me that, who was it that said? Yeah, it was JF at the end of that. He said that Kraut was actually a sort of a next level SJW.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it, because I think the old gen. Yeah, go on. You go on.
I think let's start at the start. Let's talk about what, in your view, what is the SJW, the sort of classical, the thing that we know of as that. How would you describe that person politically and psychologically?
Right, an SJW is. I'm going to use simple terms here. I'm not going to try and get too elaborate here. If we just talk about cultural Marxism, an SJW is the activist of the cultural Marxist. I think that's I like to keep things as simple as possible. So that's what an SJW is. But, you know, certainly if you think about SJWs in over the last 20 years or so, we didn't really call them SJWs for starters, but for whatever reason, that label that became a popular meme, but really you're just talking about far left activists, I guess, without going into too much detail.
Yeah. I mean, they existed 20 years ago when I was young, you know,
they existed in the 60s, you know,
the start of
Marxism, basically.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
1960s cultural revolution from there onwards, you know, onwards.
But the thing that I think the reason that a term became necessary for them, social justice warrior, was that they became more commonplace. Suddenly you had 18-year-olds who knew nothing about the world, but had been pumped full of cultural Marxism at university and high school, and they were spouting it off on YouTube as if they had wisdom. And so, and that was, you know, large numbers of people. And so I think that's what necessitated the term SJW.
Yeah, I think some of it has to do with this idea of shallow virtue signaling as well. That kind of coincided with the creation of the label. So your average SJW often engages in shallow virtue signaling. And there's some kid in university who has no experience of life and is often quite well-to-do, middle-class left-winger whose parents probably work in the public sector or vote Labour. And live in the suburbs, in a really nice part of the suburbs of a city somewhere. and are completely disconnected from the things that normal people have to deal with every day, like multiculturalism or like political correctness. They're above it. They're the ones whose family create the rules. They're part of the elite class, if you like. But as I say, in the 60s, I suppose, the people who we now call SJWs, they were in their early stages, weren't they? And they were coming up the ranks. They didn't have the power they have today, I guess. So that's the distinction.
Yeah, so, and also they were also up against a very clear enemy, which was traditional morality, whether it was traditional America or traditional Britain. You know, they had a raison d'etre. I mean, I don't know if even that is relevant. It's more that they just were on the warpath, whereas I think the SJW of today is far more cosseted.
Yeah, I suppose so. But for whatever reason, this label is really caught on. But for me, it's just another name for a far left ideologue. Yes, it's kind of what a far left ideologue has progressed to today when they have power, and these brainwashed drones that pump out of these Marxist university factories, and they think they know everything about the world, and they think they're really educated and clever because they've been brainwashed, and they paid for that brainwashing as well, which is, you know, all the more tragic.
Well, their parents did.
sometimes, but some of them paid for it with the debt, which is pretty damn tragic, really, on one level. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult.
Well, what I was going to say was that I'll just do my point. What I was going to say was the SJW of the 60s was, in a way, those ideas were just being explored, and they were wild. Like, I can imagine a hippie in the late 60s or early 70s saying that the concepts of man and woman are invalid and all the rest of it. But that would just be a wild, airy-fairy notion. The SJW of today completely believes that. I mean, to the extent that, you know, okay, let's just go along with the idea that they do actually believe it. And they have, and also they have all the reasoning, all the intellectual structures in place to justify it, to defend the idea, and also they have institutional backing. I mean, in the employment sector, in academia, in the media, everywhere, even in the church now.
So, well, that's it. The SJWs now, they control everything. The long march through the institutions that Gramsci talked about, or Gramsci, was, I'm not sure which one it is because my Italian pronunciation isn't great, but someone will correct me, they always do. But that long march through the institutions has now basically finished, to the point that even our myths like Star Wars, our popular culture, it's just dominated by their ideology. Because obviously, if you think of Marxism, Karl Marx said that eventually it would be the end of ideology. What he meant by that is eventually everyone's going to be a communist and you won't notice. So maybe we are basically living in the time of what Karl Marx actually dreamt of, which is just a communist dominated culture where if it's not communist, then, you know, there is no other choice except for, you know, social justice / Marxist communist ideology.
Well, I haven't seen the new Star Trek Discovery. I don't know when it came out. I think it was about a month ago or something. I was really busy at the time. I wanted to set aside time to watch it, but I never got around to it. I'll watch it in January when I'm taking a break. But it sounds fascinating because the SJWs are the militant, they are the aggressors, from what I've heard. And that seems fascinating to me.
From my position, I'm not going to watch it in the cinema or the movies.
Star Trek Discovery. Star Wars, this new thing, is another. That's exact. Yeah, another one.
I won't watch many films in the cinema now if I know they're riddled with SJW propaganda. Because if we don't step back and take their funds away from them within the choice of the marketplace, then they're just going to give us more and more and more of the same. So, yeah, I'll watch it if it's on Netflix, and I'm already paying for Netflix anyway, or somebody hands me the DVD. But aside from that, I am sort of abstaining from watching these things. And as far as Star Wars is concerned, The Force Awakens was so bad and it made me so annoyed that I just said, there's no way it can get, it's going to improve from here. I could see the writing on the wall. And I'm glad I said I wasn't going to watch it because look, nobody likes it really. That the audience score on Rotten Tomatoes is like 55, 56%. And it just, tying back to what we were saying with SJWs, it just embodies where we are now culturally. I guess in the 60s, that march just began and it aligned with the postmodern era because we're living in the postmodern era now, you know? And then you reached the point you're at now where the social justice warrior is what we call these far left ideologues. They were hippies in the 60s. And Star Wars embodies how the left dominates everything now, absolutely everything.
Yeah. I mean, I remember applying for art funding 10 years ago. I think it was in 2004. Yes, it was. And that even then, I remember that one of the questions was, how will this project promote diversity? I can't remember if it said diversity or multiculturalism. It was one of those two, maybe even both. And, you know, that was, as I say, that's 13 years ago. I imagine that now it's even more pushed even more.
I mean, it as I say, I just think in some ways you think, oh my word, look how bad things are. But counterculturally, you can definitely see the Overton window shifting. But at
Before we get onto that, because that is another thing, just one more thing I want to add. This latest thing in Britain where they're banning stereotypical depictions of, well, gender, gender stereotypes. Yeah. Now, I don't want to, obviously, it's easy to just go on and on about, oh, one more crazy thing, political correctness has gone mad and all this. It's very predictable. But this one in particular, I thought, wow, you can't show a woman cleaning up mess. Or rather, I think you can, as long as it's also shown that a man could, that the husband could have done it. This kind of, it's anal, you know, and of course it's totally ridiculous because everyone knows in the vast majority of families it is the mother who takes care of that stuff. It just is, even now.
Yeah, I mean, even if it isn't in a certain family, what they're trying to do is just ram politics down your throat all the time. You know, it's the personal is political. That is basically the attitude of the left. Everything has to be dominated by politics. And so this is what it was like living in the Soviet Union. If it wasn't pushing the narrative, the Marxist narrative, the ideological narrative, it wasn't acceptable. And people are conscious of the fact that they're just being force-fed this rubbish all the time. So if we just let people kind of do their thing, nature takes its course. So I can use myself as an example of that. I mean, we're living in an age where straight white men are persecuted, and you know, when it comes to discrimination, and you have to have these diversity quotas. So a family has to adapt around that, you know, because there are less jobs for starters. If you've got, first of all, in the 60s, you had women going out in the workplace, which made it harder for men to get jobs because men were competing with women. Now we're competing with immigrants. So you have to adapt to this environment. And so, but at the same time, you know, you've got this narrative constantly being pushed about women must do this, men must do that. You've got the Bechdel test or something for feminism in movies or something like that. I can't remember the exact name.
Yes, Bechdel.
That's the Bechdel test where women have to do a certain amount of things within the movie. Like they can't be protected. Women have to work together.
I think the Bechdel test is
a formula for that.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. And I remember seeing in some magazine recently, it said, this new TV show passes the Bechdel test in the first scene. So obviously this is something that they're now consciously aware of. And it's interesting that they had to be made consciously aware of it. You know, that they were, well, okay. The Bechdel test is
Is there a requirement that a film has to have? But it's a specific requirement.
Is there a scene where two female characters talk about something which is not related to a man, or is not a man? They talk about something other than a man. So that's the Bechdel test. And I think it's very interesting that that had to become a thing, that people had to be made consciously aware of it, because it shows how ingrained it is in us that women revolve around men. You know, that the affairs of women are really the affairs of men.
Are there other things for the Bechdel test, though? Like, for example, a woman can't be saved. Women have to work together to do certain things, because apparently The Last Jedi, I think it was reading it in The Guardian or something. Or was it a video I was watching earlier? But either way, I have been keeping up with all the news and chatter around this. And the Last Jedi, like, passes the Bechdel test on, like, every single level. It's basically the matriarchy against the patriarchy. That's how it's ultimately presented. You know, you've got the resistance, which is the matriarchy, and then you've got the, you know, the Nazis, which are the you know, the evil white patriarchal Nazis, which is the First Order. You know, and that what I find fascinating about you know, that the way this things are portrayed in culture now is you have to basically, there is no real meaning or depth in anything anymore. But the only things that come through all the time is these Marxist, cultural Marxist memes. The bad guys are the evil Nazis. You've got to have the diversity. You've got to have feminism. All these memes. And
it's becoming like everything is a blueprint for this political ideology. Everything is an example of that ideology manifesting. You know, there is no real life anymore. There's no sort of messy, organic, just the way people are, the way human beings are. Everything is aligned with that ideology. This is what and of course, it's so overbearing. You know, I'm sort of dreading watching the new Twin Peaks for this reason, although I suspect that David Lynch can get away with more than anyone else, really, nowadays. So I hope that he hasn't fallen for it. But, you know, it's just
everything
awful.
Has fallen for it, though, and it's really becoming increasingly frustrating. But what can you do other than withdraw from the mainstream culture, take your money away, take your views away? But I mean, it's pretty damn sad. It is pretty damn sad. But you just got to hope that there's light at the end of the tunnel, because it was a miserable place to live in the Soviet Union when you culturally it all had to be based around ideology. The personal is political. It always has to drive the narrative all the time. Who wants to live like that? Actually, people tend to want a break from politics and let the archetypes alone drive the story forward, the myths, the legends, the things that define you culturally. And certainly when it comes to Star Wars, I think that has become part of our mythology now. So and when it comes to the left, they want to destroy everything culturally or subvert it. And you can see how with Star Wars, that's another kind of this, that's another thing they've done that to, just decimated it. So that's something else we have no meaning to, nothing we can put our culture and our beliefs and our values to.
Yeah. And it's been co-opted so that even that nice thing from your childhood now serves this ideology. You can see it as conquest, cultural conquest. And another one would be Doctor Who. Doctor Who, I mean,
I know you
the
love
main
Doctor
thing
Who,
here is that he's now.
Your channel was based around it. You've got the Doctor Who introduction and stuff. So I used to watch it as well, but I know that you enjoyed it a lot growing up. So I bet that hit you hard.
It did. I mean, I don't really, I've sort of detached from it. And, you know, I've never been keen on the new series, the revival from 2005 onwards. I like the odd episode, but, you know, the whole thing is just so left wing. I was never able to feel at one with it. And so by the time they announced that he was going to be a woman, I was almost past caring, and I almost didn't even make a video about it. Doctor Who's a really weird one because it was always implicitly left-wing. You know, even back in definitely in the early 70s, and I know it started
was
in the early
60s. Was it noticeably left-wing, though? Because I never really... I watched it in the 80s growing up, but... I guess I need to look back at the episodes, but for me, when I look at the new Doctor Who's. Yeah, there was. It was almost much more subtle, though, the left wing element of it. So of our culture, you could tolerate it. Now it's just in your face. You know what I mean?
It's absolutely in your face. I think if I were to come up with examples, there is the infamous one from the 1988, the Happiness Patrol, which was on Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher. And then in the early 70s, there was a lot of anti-empire stuff, pro-globalization, pro-EU, anti-tradition, I can't remember if there was actual anti-racism stuff. I can't recall now, but there probably was. Your conservative grandfather in the early 70s would probably look at Doctor Who back then and think, and be annoyed by it. But now, obviously, it looks just quite conservative by today's standards. I mean, I remember there's one episode where a farmer says to his wife, well, go on, woman, get on with it. You know, and obviously that's a world away from the programme today. You'd never get a man talking to his wife like that.
I mean, the argument always is that when it comes to kind of the arts, performing arts, there's always a liberal element to it, a left-wing element. But as I say, there's definitely a contrast there, because what a lot of these artists did is they built on what came before, you know? So if you're an artist, you would build on, because the idea is that art would improve through the ages, isn't it? It's certainly with the fine arts. And you would probably know what I'm talking about in that regard, because I know you're an artist yourself. But that all went out the window with postmodernism, you know? So there was no reason to keep improving art. That wasn't a real thing. But at the same, so you could say, I suppose, art is always something that is quite liberal. If that's, I don't necessarily use the word left wing, but it always has a liberal element to it. But what we've got now is the question of whether, you know, there is a question to ask as in relation to whether liberal and left wing are the same thing, I suppose, because what we've got now is this far left madness that's dominating everything. And maybe that's the distinction.
And is anti-liberal as well. It's not liberal in the sense of being open-minded. It simply isn't. That's gone.
Yeah. So that's the mainstream culture anyway. You know, it's just dominated in this fashion, which is why, which I think could tie into how things are going counterculturally, I suppose, which I think is a very different picture in a lot of ways, because I don't think that's reflected in the counterculture at all.
No. And so that was, let's go to that now, because I think that is very interesting. One thing I would say just to start off this is that YouTube comment threads are basically right wing.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's a very blanket statement. Obviously, there are plenty of left-wing channels, but the things that people see, the comments that you can see on YouTube under videos are things that you could never see in real life, in the workplace, even at the bus stop. People can be viciously right-wing on YouTube.
I think they've got a natural, innate right-wing tendency. I mean, a fascinating example of that is because of all the drama that took place this year with the adpocalypse, I did start checking out PewDiePie's channel. Now, there are things about PewDiePie which you may not be aware of, and bear in mind he's the largest YouTube channel out there. And he said in his video I watched last night of The Last Jedi, he doesn't like forced diversity. You know, and he tends to make jokes when it that mock feminism and social justice as well. So you can see that's a perfect example of how YouTube is tends to be quite right wing. A lot of people are getting red pilled by the fact that they're getting this stuff forced down their throat. What people want when they watch a movie or read a book is they want to feel as though they're just enjoying something real, something artistic, a story. And that is just something from the mind or the heart of the creator. But what you get with the left is just things being forced upon you artificially with no consideration for the for the substance or the content that or the art itself, which is why I think say a lot of movies are so bad these days. There is nothing creative behind it, nothing real. It just feels plastic, you know?
Yeah, and I would say the same about Doctor Who.
Yeah, absolutely. So certainly when it comes to YouTube, when you realize this, you also realize why I think there's such a clampdown. There's been such a clampdown this year on YouTube and the internet, because this is something organic, something real. And whenever you have that space of where people can come together in an organic way, then basically I think the truth will out, I suppose. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody's going to be, you know, completely right wing on every issue, but certainly when it comes to tradition and morality, I think people are much more right wing than some might think.
Yeah. An interesting thing that was pointed out to me a year ago is that the more anonymous people become, the more right wing they become. Because in the workplace, for example, you're totally known and you're very vulnerable. And so people spout left-wing platitudes. On the street, you might be a bit more adventurous with your the things you say to a friend. Because, yes, you're visible, but nobody knows your name or address. And then on the internet, people might know your name, but they don't know who you are, your address or whatever. So you'll say something a bit more adventurously right-wing on a forum. And then if you have a fake name on a forum, then you'll be even more uninhibited. And then finally, if you're an anon on 4chan, you're totally uninhibited. And I think that's very interesting. You know, the more anonymous people become, the more ferociously right-wing the things they say become.
Maybe that's the shy Tory effect as well, you know, the shy conservative. This is why I don't believe any of these polls anymore. And I think this year has really been about thinking, well, you know, look what happened in 2016. So the powers that be had to kind of clamp it down on the internet, clamp down on free speech, look for all these excuses, like this one Nazi video that had an advert on it. And then that means that the whole of the internet has to be purged. Who saw this video? I never did. And of course, we found out in Adpocalypse Part 2 that there were all these really questionable videos geared towards children still out there. And I've noticed this sort of stuff a lot as well. So you can see how the hypocrisy exists as well. I mean, on one hand, Google is, or Alphabet Inc. or YouTube are just a typically faceless organization that only care about money. So they ignore all these disgusting videos geared towards children. But on the other hand, they just get manipulated for every moral outrage that SJWs manufacture.
Yeah. I mean, they're largely staffed by SJWs nowadays.
Exactly. So certainly, culturally, in the counterculture, that is, I think we are winning. But a lot of that depends on whether really we can maintain our free speech online. It's been a year of ups and downs, but I don't know whether I think next year is going to be very, very telling. If we lose control of the internet and things go downhill next year, I think it could get very bad very quickly. And that's what kind of worries me myself.
I think the anons will be okay. I think the comment threads will continue to be right wing, but I think the talking heads are more vulnerable.
Yeah. I think there's certainly something to that. Yeah, I would agree. But another good example, I think, of the way the internet is more conservative or right wing. You know, these are labels you need to flesh out, but I'm just going to throw them out there now. You know, right wing, conservative, nationalistic, pro-controlled immigration, these sorts of values you would traditionally associate with the right, is the way, you know, the whole Kraut and Tea drama, which obviously has resulted in Kraut and Tea destroying himself. Because we made the distinction at the beginning, didn't we, in relation to social justice warriors. Yeah. And I think, you know, the new social justice warriors, we were sort of talking about this, weren't we, at the start, how I think before we went live, how what that social justice warriors may well have evolved to become people like Kraut and Tea. Because I made a live stream about Kraut and Tea, and I said, I called it Kraut and Tea's True SJW Nature. That was a good few weeks ago, and I think now it's pretty apparent that, yeah, he is about as SJW as it gets.
Now, this is a very interesting thing, and I can't remember whether we were talking about this before we went on air or at the very beginning of being on air, but certainly what was said was that J.F. Garipi, in my hangout with him last night, said that Kraut was a sort of next-level SJW. He was a development that could still see the light of day, although JF thinks that it won't. Hmm. But I suppose how would you characterize this sort of SJW next version? I suppose it's somebody who believes in liberty and natural egalitarianism and culture. A hierarchy comes from culture, but people innately are all equal.
It's certainly something that we are going to need to flesh out. But I think one of the issues is that they believe in the blank slate, tabula rasa. So they don't care about race. They don't really think that biology matters. They kind of accepted it with feminism, though. Because I did a video at the start of the year called The Next Wave of the Conservative Revolution. Well, we won't get bogged down in whether you want to say conservative or right wing here. But what I was saying in that video is, me being somebody that's been online for a while, I've seen the progression. So when I first went onto YouTube, I was quite left wing at that time, but feminism was red pilling me. So I started talking about feminism as I was discovering other things. And I got quite involved with men's rights at that point. Then girls' rights, what came along, and the men's movement kind of took off, but at the same time, kind of killed itself. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of us will know about Sandre Guy now being Kraut and T's kind of minion. He was involved in the left way, the left ruining men's rights way back then. So, and he did a video to me criticizing me when I said, lefties and feminism is left wing, and we're never going to get anywhere if feminism is if the men's movement goes to the left. Sure enough, the men's movement kind of died then. And even back then, very quickly, though, I realized I didn't really get involved in the race thing so much, but I was very quick to realize that, well, yeah, race exists. It pretty much does exist. And I kind of had a bit of a conservative / libertarian awakening then. And lo and behold, now we've reached this point, which is kind of the awakening on race and immigration and the whole globalist thing. And what Kraut and Tea represents, I think, what I said back then with that video at the start of the year, is that this is the wave we're on now. And the people that keep denying race and don't get behind the acceptance of, say, national heritage for white people and this sort of thing related to, let's say, nationalism, I guess, as a broad umbrella, they're going to destroy themselves. And Kraut and Tea, lo and behold, has utterly destroyed himself. And we have to wonder, say, with somebody a very successful person in the so-called skeptic community that Kraut and Tea is involved with, whether someone like Sargon of Akkad, you can see him backing away now and realizing this isn't, is this really, I think he's probably reached a point where he thinks this isn't a battle worth fighting anymore because it's not when you can really win. But yeah, the truth is coming out.
Yeah, it's also become too ideological for him. It's become too coldly ideological. Sargon of Akkad, I think it would be fair to say he is kind of ideological. He has principles, and he does want a system. He believes in he has a belief system that supports those principles. Let's put it that way. But he is fairly pragmatic at the same time. I mean, he's not a total ideologue. Whereas I think the skeptic community beneath him, down in, below decks, is becoming ideological, or was. I think it's now imploded.
Yeah, I mean, this whole idea of a skeptic community. There are people in the skeptic community that I like. Like Dave Cullen, for example. I think he's an honourable guy. He's generally a good guy.
I agree.
And then there are others like Academic Agent, who I think is a nice guy, and he seems like a decent guy, but I just think he's misguided, really. although, say, economically, he's quite libertarian, actually. But he's an example of somebody, a lot of people within the skeptic community now, who are, less, should we say, libertarian, which is where they believe in the blank slate, but they don't care about immigration, the neo-conservative attitude. And I think we've moved past that now. The counterculture is very firmly in the root of saying white people have an identity, they have a heritage, they deserve the right to exist, they deserve a right to a homeland.
And they do exist as well. That's the first thing. Yes. White people do exist. There is a thing, there is a collective, an entity called white people. And to say that, well, each individual white person, it doesn't add up to much. It's just they're all individuals. That no longer holds.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely. Been totally...
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so you can see that progression now, but at the same time, the frustrating thing is, which ties into why we need to get our act together in 2018, is in the mainstream culture, things haven't caught up yet. Now, usually the counterculture leads the way and the mainstream culture kind of is dragged along over time, which is what we can see. We can see that in the 60s. But the other thing is that maybe the powers that be are kind of trying to take away our platform to speak to stop that happening. So I feel as though 2018 is a really important year for us if we're going to replicate what we've done in the counterculture, in the mainstream culture, in the scheme of time.
Yes, I agree. I think that Gab, BitChute, and Minds.com will probably become more central parts of our lives. And I don't like saying that because I would rather hold on to Twitter. I would certainly rather hold on to YouTube. But I can see, I can see it coming. You know, the thing is, though, I said this time last year, and I think I said it this time 2 years before as well. I mean, there's only so much they can get away with. This whole thing with putting videos on limited state, I think it's made YouTube look ridiculous. Honestly, I don't know if they'll go back on it, but I think it is not. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes that kind of authoritarianism. But then again, they are ideologically bound to do this stuff.
Absolutely. But then there is that lawsuit with PragerU as well, which is kind of like light at the end of the tunnel. Will they be able to get away with suing Google in a Trump administration? But at the same time, it's just they're desperate. The establishment, the left, globalists, they're desperate to overturn everything we achieved in 2016. They don't want us to leave the EU, which is another major issue, that the Brexit thing with the UK. And then there's the situation with them constantly trying to get Trump impeached, basically.
Yes, and the dishonesty is, I mean, that's a huge conversation in itself. Let's just say for now that the dishonesty is astonishing.
Absolutely.
Regarding Trump, you know, that all of the lies, all of the endless pathetic and petty attempts to smear him, it's just disgusting. I mean, these are grown people with university degrees and all that, and they're pathetic. They're like squabbling schoolgirls.
Mm-hmm. And I think another thing I did mention in my video at the start of the year was how Gamergate was kind of like the defining moment, because for whatever reason, Gamergate became the last stand. I mean, I'm a gamer. I've been a gamer since the days of the ZX Spectrum and the Commodore 64, which I'm sure you're well aware of, Millennial Rose. So, you know, I'm 39 now and I still play games. And Gamergate was that moment where men put their foot in the ground and they said, "You will not pass." They did a Gandalf. They put their staff in the ground and they said to the demon, I can't remember the demon in Lord of the Rings specifically, Balrog or something like that. He put his staff, and he put his staff in the ground and he said, "You shall not pass." So when that happened, you had people of all political persuasions come together under this mantle of Gamergate. But it was very quickly, the same thing happened. That always happens. Whenever a movement takes place, left-wing people attach themselves to it and try to co-opt it. And I think this was the entry point for people like Sandra Guy, who did it with the men's movement, Then he did it through Gamergate with the skeptic community. And now, and you also had Crouton T present himself as this come along off the back of the Gamergate and then transitioned into this so-called skeptic community. Mm. And yeah, that I think that's that there's a certain pattern that's emerging there. But I think these people are being purged.
I think also, I'm not sure about Spinosaurus, kind of, if he emerged Gamergate, but I know that he used to, like a year ago, described himself as a skeptic, and his Twitter now says progressive.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm not sure how much you're aware of with Spinosaurus, Kin.
More than I'd like to be aware of, to be honest. Yeah.
So he fell out with, he was actually more left-wing than, say, even, well, certainly Sargon of Akkad, he admits he's a leftist, and he was kind of like a Trojan horse, a double agent. He went in there to infiltrate the so-called skeptic community and then basically kind of stabbed them in the back. So he got purged for being more too left-wing. And now you've got Crouton T being purged for being too left-wing, for doing things like doxing. And you can kind of see the Overton window shifting, can't you? I think it's becoming pretty apparent.
Yeah, I wonder where it will leave the skeptic community. Because they claim to be centrists. That's their thing, that they're in the middle. They don't fall for those ideas. They don't fall for those ideas. They're always objective. But this has disgraced them.
And it's shown that they're not centrists, are they? I mean, what the heck is a centrist anyway? I mean, the communists in the 50s and the 60s were calling themselves moderates. It's the same rubbish, isn't it? So, you know, it's just, it's just a front, isn't it? You know? But you can kind of establish what you mean by a centrist. Or we don't have an ideological position. Well, so what does that mean? How do you establish what's right and wrong then? What are your principles? What do you believe? And actually, when you strip it all down, it's just that they're left wing.
Yeah, I think what they would say is that they're pro freedom and they're pro equality. And, you know, that's in the end, you have to choose between those two things. And I think they choose equality.
And do you know what's interesting as well? I think another major telltale sign that these people are left-wing is we talk a lot about the freedom of speech and the First Amendment in the United States Constitution being the bedrock of that, the quintessential example. But the other part of the First Amendment is freedom of association, which is the right to associate with whom you please, which ties into white people having the right to associate with those that are, you know, their own kind, if they want to. Now, if you speak to even Sargon of Akkad, has a major issue with this freedom of association thing. And they put a lot of onus on free speech. But then even that they're not perfect on. Because if you look at Kilroy, they purged all the people that weren't of their kind from the event as soon as they got the money from the alt-right who supported it, which Coach Redpill talked about in his video uploaded around the time of this live stream. And it's just very interesting, isn't it, really, that their interpretation of free speech, as usual, is very subjective. And they just use that.
They specifically said that there is no place for identitarianism at this conference.
Yeah, but what do they mean by identitarianism? If they're talking
exactly what you just described, people taking an interest in their white identity. I mean, it obviously can be used by any people of any race, but it was white people who were going to discuss identitarianism. I think it was a panel discussion, and they were told, I believe it was, yes, it was by a Base Mama, that there is no, that identitarianism has no place in this conference or something like that.
And this is something that I had a little exchange on Twitter recently. And the thing that came, like a tweet, there was a tweet by someone who will remain nameless, but it was trying to suggest that, you know, basically Islam, belief in race and feminism are the same thing. Now, this is what people don't understand. Feminism and Islam are an ideology. Now, if you believe race is real, that is just biological. That's just science. You know, if you believe men and women are different, that's just science. So there's a distinction between making statements of fact about identity based on biology and an ideology like feminism, which basically denies science, and, you know, Islam, which is a political ideology of conquest. And this is what these so-called centrists don't understand. If you say, you know, I'm a man, I like to hang out with guys from time to time, and I like to have a club with men because, you know, I just want to hang out with the guys from time here and there when appropriate for certain things, that's not the same as a feminist that says, you know, gender, sex, you know, sex and gender are two different things, and we shouldn't be teaching boys to be masculine because and we shouldn't be teaching women to be feminine. I mean,
this is just crazy. Yeah. This is the hate identity politics, and therefore they cannot stand any type of identity politics, even when one type comes up that's actually completely legitimate.
Yeah, or self-evident even. I mean, is it even politics, really, to say that I'm a man or I'm white? I'm just saying, you're a white guy. I just kind of, you know, I like my culture. I like my identity. I like the fact that my biology has extended into my culture. It's created this wonderful civilization. I don't want it to die, just like I don't want Japanese culture to die, or I don't want, you know, South American culture to die, or, you know, African culture. That is true diversity, isn't it? But, you know, this is something that I think we're all well aware of at this point, or certain people, certainly people that would be listening to this, a lot of them would be.
Yeah. I'll end with two questions from the chat for you. What do you think of the idea that leftists hate us because we're like a mirror? When they look at us, we say what they dare only think, and they hate themselves for it.
Well, the left constantly projects, don't they? So, you know, that's something that Vox Day said in his great book, SJWs Always Lie, and it's pretty damn obvious. It's cowardice, it's groupthink, it's the inability to stand out, and the need to basically be within stay within the safety and confines of a crowd. So yeah, they look at us as people who are prepared to stand up and speak the truth or take a moral stand, and yet I guess there is a bit of resentment there. I definitely think that, and that's the projection element. Yeah,
I also think that they know that certain of their beliefs are drivel. You know, like men and women are the same, and the races are the same, and all that. I think it takes effort to continue believing those things. And I think that they must look at us and just hate us, A, for not being afraid to believe these things, and B, for trying to spread the word. You know, because we're getting in the way of their delusion.
And, you know, when you're taking the hits you take and you keep coming back and standing up, I think there might be an element of, well, dare I say, jealousy? Because, you know, I think we at least have the common sense to realize that if we don't take a stand on what's true and what's right, then you lose all your freedom, don't you? And the world, because lies lead to injustice. If you deny that race exists because you think, oh, well, it's kind of more polite to say it doesn't exist. Well, look what it's led to. It's led to white people being shamed about absolutely everything, whether it's their fault or not.
And that's they get deconstructed. Yeah, they get totally deconstructed, and ultimately they're going to lose everything, including their own existence. Yeah, that's what this is. It's that serious. All right. So the other question is, do you think people who gravitate to social justice could funnel their revolutionary zeal into something productive if they had a conservative society to lead them?
I'm not sure about that, because I think a lot of the people that generally gravitate towards social justice are damaged in some way. I think there's something going on psychologically, and then basically they don't see the world in the same way. They, for example, they've had kind of adverse experiences growing up. They might have been bullied in school, for example, and it tarnishes their view of the world in some way. Or they might have been abused at home. It could be physical, mental, emotional. It could be physical, mental, sexual. And they're damaged.
Or they're just low T. Or they're just low T. You know, I mean, in the case of the guys, and there's not much you can do about that, honestly. Well, I mean, there are things you could do. But what I mean is,
it would help, wouldn't it?
Apparently, I've got to say it. Apparently, that is just a myth.
I'm skeptical about that one, but that's a whole other subject.
It's an amusing myth at any rate. And in the case of the women, I do think that in the case of female SJWs, it is largely cultural. Now, no doubt in this day and age, there will be lots of girls who have dysfunctional relationships with their fathers. I dare say that's true. So in that case, you can attribute it to their upbringing and all that. But I think a lot of it is just cultural, because women are so conformist. And so if you tell them what to believe, I'm sorry to say it, but they do just believe it. They are the upholders of the status quo. And the status quo is now taught in high school and certainly university as cultural Marxism. So I don't think in their case it relies so much on being disturbed or whatever. Although I think that the ideology leads to them being disturbed, because they're then fighting against their instincts as women and so on. And so at that point, the ideology starts to sustain itself. In other words, feminism has messed you up. So what do you need? More feminism. Because you can attribute the damage not to feminism, but to a patriarchal society or whatever. The fact that no man is attracted to you is not because you're overweight with piercings and tattoos all over you, and you do nothing to make yourself attractive physically or in terms of personality to men. It's because of the patriarchy. That's why men don't fancy you. So, well, at that point, you've got a girl who's 25 or whatever, and she's a total wreck. And it's humiliating for her to admit that she fell for something which led her to make herself unattractive. It's much easier for her to say to herself, no, this just proves the ideology is correct in the first place.
Yeah, you double down on something, you go to university, you spend all this money to educate yourself. And yeah, it's very difficult at that point to back away and say, you know what, I made a mistake and I'm in loads of debt for it. But of course, with all the conditioning and the brainwashing that people are receiving now, by the time they're, 12, 13, 14, 15, they're so brainwashed at that point, it's very hard to break that conditioning. You're a person that tends to think for yourself, a bit more critical, they're always, those kinds of people are generally capable of breaking away from it. But I mean, I don't know, I couldn't tell you exactly what percentage of people in society are like that. But apparently, according to Aldous Huxley, it's, around 20% or something. So you're always going to get that percentage which will resist any kind of conditioning and want to figure things out for themselves through critical thinking. So there is that element as well. So it's also defining what brainwashing or what abuse is, or these adverse experiences. Is the brainwashing itself within the system a form of abuse or adverse experience?
Yeah, indeed. One last question, a follow-up to one of the previous ones. How do we integrate these? And obviously, this is a big question. Don't feel pressured. Just do what you can with it. How do we integrate these chaotic, damaged people? Or must we just suppress them?
Well, this is something I'm looking into a lot at the moment for various reasons with the topics I'm covering. But as the saying, there's an old adage here, the lunatics have taken over the asylum. We don't want that to happen. So it comes down to the question of mental illness, doesn't it? Some mentally ill people can basically live relatively normal lives with a bit of support, but others are so dangerous and damaged that they're so damaged that they lash out at others, and they're a danger to themselves as well. So we need to, as a society, deal with this problem. So if you've got damaged people who are then, the thing is, as if you think about that adage of the lunatics taking over the asylum, what we've got in society now is lunatics creating laws and rules and policies in government.
Expanding
and that's really
the asylum.
What's happening with the SJWs. They're the lunatics that have taken over the asylum. And these things are evidently mad, the things they want to do and the things they say and believe. So what do we do with these people? Well, frankly, they need therapy. They need treatment. And we need to get to the point where we can treat these people as patients that can be helped. And I'm certainly not saying, you know, every single one of them needs to go in a padded cell. But let's be honest, that's probably the best place for a few of them.
Okay. I'll just end with two comments that were written by somebody. Hold on a second. Let me find the first one. Oh, yeah. The left compartmentalize everything to such an extent that they can't even see the contradictions in their own beliefs. By contrast, the right takes a more holistic approach. I don't know what you would say. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, cognitive dissonance, isn't it? You know, that's the left for you through and through. They can hold two conflicting views at the same time, and they'll just argue in circles constantly. And for me, I just haven't gotten the patience for that. If I'm in a conversation with people like that, I'll give them a few chances. If they start repeating themselves, I haven't got the time to engage them in a thread that lasts for 50 exchanges and 2 weeks.
Surely the ultimate example of this is a feminist who campaigns for Islam, for Islamic immigration, or a gay rights activist who campaigns for Islamic immigration. That is just amazing to watch. And of course, everyone's said this already. It's not an original observation, but I'd love to get one of them on a hangout and just.
It could all come down to self-loathing as well. You know, the self, they hate themselves so much that they project. Going back to the other point I made, they project that onto society. They want to see it all burn, don't they? It's that nihilism, that kind of revulsion of everything around them. And they want to destroy it all because ultimately they hate themselves and they're not brave enough to actually do the self-learning and the therapy required to better themselves. So they just rather everyone feel as miserable as they do, basically.
I also think that a lot of them just want authority. I think they crave authority. And this is the secret belief that they have in Islam. I think especially the feminists, I think they know damn well that Islam will sort them out, you know, aggressive, violently even. And I think at some level they crave that. I think that's going to sound terribly sexist, what I'm going to say, but I think that women do crave male authority. And Islam, however else you might define it, it is an example of male authority. And I think that,
You're gone.
Okay. Yeah, and the other question, sorry, do you want to comment on that?
No, that's fine. I'm happy with that, really. You made a great point there.
Right, thank you. And the other comment is, leftism is primarily economic in nature. Even their social policies are about creating more consumers, more slaves.
Economic in nature. I don't know about that. I mean, I think Marxism is a poor excuse for an economic theory. And it's kind of a social theory, almost kind of pseudo philosophy wrapped up as economics. But if you look at it at its core, at the very beginning, it was about destroying the family, destroying religion, destroying tradition, destroying monogamy, all these ideas of what the utopia would look like. And then in between all of that, we'll throw in some pseudo economic theories about how everyone's going to have everything they want. And it's very poorly thought out. Not even Marx himself fully penned every ridiculous thing that he wanted to say about his economic theory by the time he died. But I think overall, Marxism is just the leftist ideology in general. It's just utopianism. And for people that kind of, you know, people who are pretty, they loathe themselves on such a feral level that they gravitate to nonsense, basically.
Yeah. The guy has specified he wasn't talking about Marxists, he was talking about left-wing globalists.
Left-wing globalists, okay. I mean, yeah, I guess if you're going to talk about globalism, I guess you could say, there is a bit more economics there. It's strange then, though, because you kind of get this, you get the left-wing social side, but then you get the kind of corporatist side of it, which I would argue is kind of a form of socialism in its own right. So, it becomes kind of a hybrid then, which I've talked about quite a lot on my channel in various places, where globalism is basically corporatism economically and it's cultural Marxism.
Yes, I think that's a very good way to characterise it. Okay, shall we end it there then? I think this has been a very interesting and enjoyable discussion, and I'm glad that I finally had you on the channel, because as I said, I've been aware of you for years, I think 5 years, if not more.
That's about the amount of time I've been doing videos, yeah, so you were there early on.
Oh yeah, I was watching you before. I was watching you, Irini, Stardusk, who else? I did watch Girl Writes What as well. So yeah, that was all before I started mine, which is coming up for very nearly the fourth anniversary now.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. All right, well, that was Rocking Mystery, and this has been a really good one, so thank you.
Thanks again for having me on your great live stream.
Okay, thank you. And the next one is in about 50 minutes from now, and it's with Tara McCarthy. So, okay, I will see you then. Thank you, Rocking Mystery. Thank you to everyone for listening. I'll see you soon.